Well, the clock is ticking. Closer and closer. Time marches on. Terrible Tommy here, Tom Metzger in the bunker. North Central Indiana, P.O. Box 401. Warsaw, Indiana, that's where you send your snail mail, your donations, and so forth. And part of that, those donations go to our POWs. And it is January the 20th, 2015. Wow, got to get used to saying that. And it's a overcast day, cool, but not bad here. Yeah, I think it's around the 40s someplace. So anyhow, here we are, and we're ready to go with another show, and I'm going to run something for you here that we're testing out, running some audio, converting print to audio, and we're going to try this and see how it goes on some of the stuff. We're not going to put everything on there, but here we go, and this has to do with an answer from one of our wolves out there about the race issue and DNA and genetics. Okay.
There has never been a study that can show a causative relationship between DNA and intelligence, at least that has been released for review publicly. There was an Asian at a four-league school that was doing a study a few years ago, however he dropped that and said there are some things we should not know. He was studying the relationship between DNA and intelligence and reportedly was also looking at race. There is a link out there somewhere. We have good statistical evidence of the intellectual inferiority of blacks. There are physical differences such as cranial capacity. If dino fossils were found with differing cranial capacities, it would be assumed that the larger brain would result in more intelligence and the resultant of their behavior would be estimated on this with reasonable accuracy. It is an accepted method for guessing. Usually the response to a study based on stats of race and intelligence is, "How can you believe that?" The response seems to me to be an example of cognitive dissonance. The ACT stats are available to the public. They include race, ECT. You can compare the point difference between blacks and whites in Mississippi, the lowest for both, and Massachusetts, the highest for both. Blacks are nearly the same number lower in Mississippi and Massachusetts. Massachusetts has the highest ACT scores in the United States. They have the best education system in North America. That system has not produced blacks with equal intelligence to whites. Blacks do not have large numbers in Massachusetts as they do in Mississippi, so they are not concentrated in single school districts. So the low scores cannot be attributed to inequality. They are in white schools. There is no system in existence that will produce blacks with similar intelligence levels whites or Asians. It is arguable that there is no education system anywhere that is a major improvement on the Massachusetts system. I don't know if these are still available, but they are pretty good, so I will send them as an attachment. There are more if you want them. All of these are from Rushton.
That's the first time I've used that program, and there was one little bit of slowdown there, but that was me tinkering with it, so don't blame that on the program. So what are we going to name our new employee here? You guys want to come up with a name? She sounded pretty good to me. I've got a whole CD here someplace with about, I don't know how many names on it, how many different voices. But I'm going to put that in the machine and see what we can get to out of it. we might be able to get all kinds of, I should be able to get all kinds of voices. Well, this story was submitted by Merchandise, the webmaster, merchandiseresist@yahoo.com. So what do you got to say? How about that? Just a second here. Let's go. All right.
Our top story on Midday Edition, The march of technology has made war more horrible than our ancestors ever imagined. When we think of that, we likely think of nuclear bombs. But what should we think of drones? They are amazing bundles of modern technology, allowing airstrikes to occur via computer control and GPS. On one hand, the U.S. military and the Obama administration see unmanned aerial vehicles, as they're also called, as aircraft that can hit our enemies very accurately wherever they are. Critics see violations of privacy, illegality, and the killing of innocent civilians. My guest to talk about this subject is Marjorie Cohn. She's a law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and author of a new book called Drones and Targeted Killing, The Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issue. She joins me in studio. And thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure, Tom.
Well, Marjorie Cohn, tell us about your book. This is a collection of writings on U.S. airstrikes abroad.
It is indeed. The foreword is written by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who reacts to American exceptionalism, where Americans are not so concerned when our bombs kill people in other countries, but when drones kill citizens, U.S. citizens, then they are concerned. And then lawyers, philosophers, policy analysts, activists talk about different aspects of this policy.
Yeah. When did the U.S. start using drones for targeted killings?
It really started during the Bush administration when there was a targeted killing of a car in Yemen. And Obama has taken it to a new level. During the Obama administration, more people have been killed by drones than died on 9/11. Drones are Obama's weapon of choice for targeted killing.
So where do these drone strikes occur, typically, and who are they going after?
The drone strikes have occurred in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in areas where we are not formally at war, such as Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan, and now most recently Syria. And they're going after so-called militants or terrorists, but less than 2% of the people killed by U.S. drones are high-level al-Qaeda or Taliban leaders.
Where did you get that information, according to whom?
The information comes from several sources, including, I believe, the Council on Foreign Relations.
I didn't have time to read this book, but based on what I did have time to read and the promotional blurbs on the book cover, this entire collection of essays seems to make the case against drone killings. Would you agree?
I certainly would.
Okay, well, so why did you write this book? What was your purpose?
I wrote this book because the number of people, and mostly civilians, by the way, have been killed with drones, was increasing under the Obama administration. It is Obama's weapon of choice because American pilots can't be shot down, and we don't really hear about it. It's off of our radar. But not only is this policy illegal, not only is it immoral, but it actually is counterproductive. It actually creates more enemies against the United States, not less. Because when people see their loved ones being killed by drones, being taken out, the rescuers, the people at funerals, women and children, they want to do us harm. And so it's actually, the blowback from drones actually hurts the United States.
You know, I mentioned the fear of nuclear weapons in my introduction. The first essay in your book, I believe, is called Why Drones Are More Dangerous Than Nuclear Weapons by Richard Falk. More dangerous than nuclear weapons?
The reason that he takes this position is that nuclear weapons have not been used since 1945 except for deterrence and coercive diplomacy. But drones are used increasingly. They're subject to no regulation. And the proliferation of drones, and we see this in this country with photography drones and drones at the border, surveillance drones, and I think we're going to see armed drones at the border eventually. Drones from Amazon, drones all over the place, drones near misses between drones and airplanes at airports. Because of this technology, it's only going to become more pervasive. And so I thought that it was important to shed light on this practice.
Well, you got into this already a bit, but what is the moral argument against drones?
The moral argument is that although the people in charge, people in power, say that they're very precise. They're not. They are only as precise as the intelligence that we receive. And many times we don't get the so-called bad guys. We get other people. We get civilians. And this is immoral. It's also illegal because it's illegal under the Geneva Conventions to indiscriminately target civilians.
Well, the Pentagon would probably argue that they're not indiscriminately targeting people.
Then why do 98% of these drone attacks hit people who are not high-level al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders, if that's the case?
My guest is Marjorie Cohn. She's a law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and author of Drones and Targeted Killing, the Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Earlier today, I spoke with a man who takes a different opinion on drones, and we're going to hear from him for a few minutes, and after that, Marjorie Cohn will have a chance to respond. This is retired Lieutenant General David Deptula, who led the U.S. Air Force's drone program from 2006 to 2010. General Deptula, why do you believe drones are so effective in the fight against terrorist organizations today?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, Tom. Quite frankly, the biggest one is that the persistence that they provide allows the U.S. government and our allies to observe, evaluate, and act very quickly, or to take all the time necessary to be absolutely sure of a particular action before one takes it. As a result of that, they provide us our asymmetric advantage in dealing with challenges like terrorists. But at the same time, they're extremely precise means of employing force in a way that actually reduces collateral damage and minimizes casualties more than any other means of force application today.
I'll
just throw in one other piece.
Okay.
That is often misunderstood and overlooked, in that drones actually allow for more ethical oversight than any other means of force application.
Now, there have been innocent people who have been killed in drone strikes. Do you consider that to be a problem?
Look, innocent people losing their lives is a challenge using any means of force application. But the use of drones is a means to minimize the loss of innocent life.
Can't take any more of that bullshit. This is war criminals. These guys with these sort of airplanes, so-called zeroing in on people, killing all kinds of innocent people. Why? First of all, we shouldn't be there in the first place. We're invading and occupying other people's countries. Or we're buying off the leader of the country so we can be there. And sooner or later, they're going to use those drones militarily in this country. You wait and see if major rioting, things like that, break out at some point in the future. You watch it. Anything the military uses outside this country will be used inside this country if they deem it necessary. Incidentally, I was reading in a book last night that Adolf Hitler, of course, he didn't develop the atomic bomb. And they asked some of his scientists after the war, why not? And they said that he observed atomic energy as Jew science, which it is. And in the long run, it's not doing us any good, nuclear power. We're going to live to regret it, because these spent rods and everything, they can't figure out where to bury them and everything, and they keep piling up. I mean, we're not talking about a few years. We're talking about they're going to be around for thousands of years. So they got Einstein, he's such a wonderful guy, and Oppenheimer and all these Jews that developed the bomb. But let's look at it this way. We've got potential atomic bomb explosions setting around in almost every state in the country with these nuclear plants. They're dangerous as hell. And these people say, well, you want to go back to the old way, horse and buggy? Hell yes. It wouldn't bother me a bit to go back to the old days. Oh, boy. So the juice, it is Jew science. And I'm glad that Hitler never got one developed or never even pushed the program. Finally, Papa the Pope has said something that makes sense. Pope Francis, after a visit to the largest Catholic nation in Asia, says Catholics may have a moral responsibility to limit the number of their children and need not produce like rabbits. But the Pope also reaffirmed the Church's ban on artificial means of birth control and said Catholics should practice responsible parenting. Well, it's one thing for you to say that. You never had a wife or a girlfriend. I don't know. Maybe you have, but the point is, what the hell do you know about it? You remember when somebody bombed that Jewish center in Argentina back in 1994? They've been trying to investigate it and zero in on the culprits for a long time. And finally, it was about ready to go to trial, or getting at least towards that. And the prosecutor was murdered. So, do we have a bunch of World War II Nazis down there in Argentina, or are these the new ones? How about that? Well, we got some more religious violence. Yeah. 3 Muslims killed after there was a murder of a Hindu. 3 Muslim civilians have been burned to death after Hindu assailants set fire to dozens of homes, a Muslim community, in an apparent retaliatory attack in eastern India. Oh, boy. All these loving religions are at it again. Well, things are heating up over in France again. The number of anti-Muslim incidents in France has soared since the Islamists attacked in Paris 2 weeks ago. An organization that tracks Islamophobia said Monday. The National Observatory Against Islamophobia said 116 anti-Muslim incidents have been reported to authorities since the January 7 to 9 shooting spree by three French jihadists that killed 17. Well, you notice, just like over here, when Morris Conman Dees puts these figures out, they say an incident. Well, what do you mean an incident? Was it somebody getting their head chopped off, or was it somebody spitting on somebody's shoes? There's a lot of difference. The 2-week tally was more than double the number of incidents recorded for the full month of January, the observatory said, reporting 28 attacks on places of worship and 88 threats. There you go. I don't think it's going to cool down very soon. And to that, French far-right leader Marine Le Pen urged the government Sunday to denounce as Islamist the perpetrators of the deadly Paris attacks that left the country reeling. I doubt whether the country was reeling. They had no earthquakes. The 3-day killing spree that left 17 dead in and around Paris started with gunmen storming. Well, we know that. They tell it over and over and over again. But Ms. Le Pen said, let's call things by the rightful name since the French government seems reluctant to do so, unquote. Le Pen wrote in the New York Times op-ed. But I remember when she was recently running for office, she was bragging about using Islamic people in her campaign. Ms. Le Pen, you can't play both sides of the fence here. Of course, like I've said many times, the Le Pens are like a lot of these other people. They're conservative right-wing types. And they will use, just like the left does in their politics, they'll use certain hot-button issues to gain power. And then once they get the power, they'll forget everything about how they got it. Yeah. One of these black boys, a little rough on their mamas and daddies here. Two police officers fatally shot an agitated man armed with at least one knife early Monday morning before finding his mother stabbed to death on the front steps of their home. That was up in Massachusetts. You probably heard yesterday about the fitness model that was killed by a train standing on the tracks, was standing on the wrong tracks. Friends of fitness model and actor who was hit by a train and killed while making a video said Monday that he was a bold and fearless person who just made a rare mistake. Yeah, that is a pretty good mistake, stepping in front of a train. And he was a white boy, too. Remember that Jew that got nabbed down in Cuba, put away for 5 years? Well, Alan Gross imprisoned for 5 years in Cuba after trying to give internet service to Cuban Jews. I don't believe that's why he was put in the prison. I do not believe that. He will be President Obama's guest tonight at the State of the Union. Wow. I don't care. Netanyahu, nitwit, and Israel still hate your guts, Obama. Well, you know, what's the best nights for profits at the pawn shop? Well, the best nights for business, Harrison said, who owns a pawn shop, are fight nights, when hundreds of thousands of fans flood Las Vegas to bet on boxing. Quote, someone has to lose, he says. Quote, I don't know what it's about fight fans, what it's about them. They always bet more than they can afford to lose, unquote. Sometimes after the fights, he says, fans line up down the block around his store, waiting to trade in their jewelry for cash. And who buys the jewelry from Harrison? Pimps. And there's a good reason why. Quote, when you get arrested for pandering, they take your cash because the cash was obtained illegally. But they don't take away your jewelry, unquote. Harrison explains, quote, and a pimp knows that if he buys jewelry in a pawn shop, if he brings it back to the pawn shop and gets a loan against it, they'll always get half of what you paid for it, as opposed to buying it in a jewelry store when they don't know what they are going to get. So when they get arrested, they will always have someone bring their jewelry down to me. I will loan them half of what they have paid for it, and that's their bail money, unquote. So there you go, boys. You're going to go around these hot spots. You better carry some jewelry with you. Well, this is There Goes the Neighborhood story. A breached pipeline in Montana has spilled as many as 50,000 gallons of crude oil in and around Yellowstone River. According to the state, Bridger Pipeline, LLC, has yet to determine the cause, but has claimed the public is in no immediate danger, except the people who drink the water downstream. Boy, I'll tell you, they need to really sock it to these people. I mean, put the CEOs in prison for this kind of activity. Okay, boys and girls, let's get back at it here. I had to take a little break and go to my acupuncturist. Hey, a foxy young chick, too. How about that? Hey, let's get serious here and get back into the Bible, the devil's book. Believe it. Of course, I don't believe in the devil, so. But anyhow, it makes a good cover for the book. Provided this is true, Heydrich surely was not the only Nazi leader who took care of that clues shedding light upon his family tree were not easily to find. The same is true as far as Jewish documents regarding this subject are concerned. One can easily imagine that from this side, too, there was and still is a little enthusiasm about bringing to light papers which prove that one or other of the Nazi heavyweights was of Jewish origin. Neither side wants to talk about that, man. That reminds me of a book report I heard last night, late in the night, from an author who's written a book, and here again, I've forgotten it already, but it's about the real, supposedly the real story about all the German rocket scientists that went to the United States, especially, and then Russia, too. So anyhow, I'm going to be talking about that. That's sort of embarrassing, not for me, but for Germans. Anyhow, here we go. In this matter, one has to consider the undeniable fact that many Nazi leaders did not actually look like people of Teutonic Nordic stock. Take, for instance, Dr. Goebbels. In his youth at school, he seemed to have a nicknamed Rabbi. It is said that he descended from a line of Sephardic Jews. I don't know. A lot of Sephardic Jews look pretty Germanic. Anyhow, or take the Fuhrer himself and listen to his speeches. Were this kind of speeches the average German statesman delivered, or did they sound more like speeches of an Old Testament prophet? Some NSDAP proponents bore family names that were much in use among the Jews, so the name Hess or Hesse turns up no less than 7 times in the Grotjudik National Biography. The name Frank with CK and then Frank and then another form of Frank crops up 13 times, and the name Rosenberg is mentioned 14 times. In 1931, Alfred Rosenberg, the main ideologist of the National Socialists, who was later to become the Reichsminister of the occupied territories in the East, paid a visit to London. He met with Lord Beaverbrook, owner of the Daily Express, the Sunday Express, and the Evening Standard. The press tycoon later described his visitor in these terms, quote, "He's a strong anti-Semite, is Hitler's representative, and like many other men who are opposed to the Jews, he has their racial marks upon him," unquote. Also, on a Jewish cemetery in Budapest, Hungary served people with the name Hitler, or the like, are said to have been buried. The notion that Hitler may have been of Jewish origin by way of his father's father was a rumor which already was going around before the war in Germany, thanks to the biography of the Führer, which Conrad Haydn published in 1936 in Zurich, Switzerland. In 1930, a worried Hitler ordered his lawyer, Hans Frank, the later Governor General of occupied Poland, to look into this story. Frank had concluded that it could have been true. The question concerning Hitler having had a Jewish grandfather is repeated concerning other Nazi heavyweights. Take, for instance, the case of Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring, who was the second man in the Third Reich for some years. His story goes as follows. In the month of May 1885, a certain Dr. Heinrich Ernst Göring, aged 56, and Franziska Fanny Tiefelbrunn, who were more than 20 years younger, were married to each other in London. Heinrich Göring was a colonial civil servant whom Bismarck had appointed as governor of German Southwest Africa, the present state of Namibia in Africa. Heinrich Göring became friends with an Austrian Jew, a corpulent, black-haired doctor named Hermann von Epstein. The doctor had assisted in 1885 when Fanny Göring gave birth to her first child. Later, Fanny would bear another 4 children. Like the first child, they all would get von Epstein as a godfather. One of these children, the one who was to become the famous Reichsmarschall, was probably named after his godfather. This Hermann Göring spent part of his youth in a castle called the Weldenstein in Frankenland. Eppenstein had bought this castle, had it restored, and placed it as a disposal of the Görings when they came home after the governor had finished his service overseas. Epstein's generosity, so we learned from Göring, biographer David Irving resulted undoubtedly from a feeling of obligation toward the old governor whose wife had openly become Epstein's mistress. In his castle, Hermann von Epstein had reserved the most beautiful room for himself. This room was close to Fanny Goring's bedroom, to which the old governor, who had lodged on the first floor, had no access. This strange triangular relationship seems to have dragged on for 15 years. The obvious question now is, was Epstein's only godfather of Hermann Goring and of Fanny's other children, or was he actually the father? Goring biographer Irving does not answer this question, but perhaps he gives us a clue by relating how Epstein, in 1938, gave Castle Wendelstein to his godchild. Until then, Epstein had spent no less than 1.5 million marks for the restoration and renewal of the castle, which he bought in 1897. This seemed to be a rather expensive present to bestow on a godchild, even when he had become Reich Marshal. Anyhow, nothing is absolutely certain, but Goring's fancy for Baroque Oriental uniforms and his sumptuous lifestyle, not only like an Oriental ruler, might be another indication that there is some un-Prussian, un-Teutonic element in his family tree. Goring was certainly not the typical son of a typical German civil servant. We are more certain about the Jewish origin of some persons who were close to Hitler in his early years as a politician. For the most part, these were National Socialists from the very beginning. Like to name but a few, Ignaz Trebisch Lincoln, Ernst Butzi Hanssegel, and the piano manufacturer Bechstein, whose wife Helene seems to have been some kind of a substitute mother for the Führer. Another certitude is Kurt von Schroeder, the influential banker from Cologne. Schroeder was a man who actually Hitler's kingmaker, who was his kingmaker. Thanks to him, Hitler was finally able to take power. That Kurt von Schroeder was of Jewish stock, we know thanks to Hitler's former political friend, Otto Strasser, who stated so explicitly in his book. Another source of this Judic Walsblatt von Magberg, which on February the 10th, 1933, wrote as follows on this man, quote, although he, Hitler, preaches the most fanatic race anti-Semitism, he has had to clear the road to power by, of all people, the race Jew Schroeder, a man who is, on top of that, a banker. That means that he can hardly be regarded as a predestined supporter of the National Socialist program on breaking interest serfdom. Schroeder was not the only Jewish sponsor of the NSDAP, however. Space does not allow us to pursue this subject, which would be worth a study of its own. I think there has been several studies of that. The question whether and to what degree Hitler and other Nazi heavyweights were indeed of Jewish origin cannot be answered affirmatively with absolute certainty. That means there is no conclusive evidence. But as we have tried to show, there are, on the other hand, lots of indications that point in that direction. And these indications, when combined with what we know about Jewish-German history in the 19th century and the 20th century, provides us with a satisfying degree of certainty. It was indeed a fact that the German Jewry played a leading role in Germany during the 19th century and first decades of the 20th century. This also was true as far as politics and intellectual life were concerned. And it was not restricted to the left side of the political arena, by no means. As a matter of fact, in their overwhelming majority, the German Jews in those days were ardent German patriots, even more ardent than the Germans themselves. Against this background, it should not be surprising at all that people with Jewish roots have been active in and around the top of the Nationalist Party like the NSDAP. The opposite, they being absent there, would have come more of a surprise. In these circumstances, it should not cause any surprise either that the ideas of the National Socialists are in many respects the spitting image of those of Jews. We shall try to show that in the following chapters. Let's see, chapter number 4. The family tree of 6 members of the Bible clad looks like this. The first branch starts from the mother of all Bible doctrines, Judaism. This generated during the 19th and 20th century 2 fresh twigs, communism and National Socialism. The second branch is the one that runs from Judaism through Christianity to the Occidental post-Christian schools of thought. The third is the final branch is Islam, which is itself partially based on the Bible. Now, and of course they believe that Jesus was a prophet, the mythical Jesus. Now that a picture of the Bible family has been drawn, we can start trying to analyze and define the common genetic code, which in this author's opinion is stored in each of the family's members. In this book, the thesis is assumed that this genetic code, the Bible doctrine, is destructive by design. It contains a program which is intended to lead man, society, and the whole world to ruin. Now we come across a problem, for it is only possible to show that something is evil when it is shown. At the same time, how things should be in order that they are morally right. One has to say why something is bad. In other words, there is a need to point for a point of comparison, a guideline, a standard, a moral norm. What moral norm? A mere theoretical moral norm can be excluded from the start. Humankind has already endured enough sufferings because we were led astray by the chimeras of intellectual alchemists who were believed to have found the infallible formula to create a brave new world, but who only managed to create quite the reverse. A typical example are the communists, who were sure they had found scientifically designed formula to reshape the planet Earth into a paradise. Since publication in 1997 of the voluminous study written by former French Marxists on the horrors of communism, we know for sure how terribly, terribly they failed. Communism has produced the very opposite of what most noble and among its followers had intended to create. Communism has produced a hell, not a paradise. Well, here again, I must say that it was much more like state capitalism than communism. Communism, in its basic, doesn't work. Can't work except in small tribal situations, and even then it's difficult. So we must look at a point of comparison which has really existed and which has nothing to do with Judeo-Christianity or what has come from it. It also seems appropriate to limit this search to Europe in order to avoid comparing European apples to non-European oranges. Taking into account this restriction, the only civilizations to qualify as a point of comparison are the heathen civilizations of old pre-Christian Europe. It should be clear that we are talking about civilizations, plural, although there are striking similarities between these cultures, so striking that they seem to suggest a common source of origin. To prevent any misunderstandings, the fact that old European heathendom will be used as a point of comparison does not mean that it is regarded as the great ideal or as a period of history when everything went well and the world was a gorgeous paradise. There's no question that the era of classical antiquity, 800 BC until 400 AD, the best known period of pre-Christian European history, has been a bloody time. Humans' lives did not matter much, and streams of blood were shed. For example, it is not only in the Bible that the practice of human sacrifices is mentioned. The Teutonic nations, Celts, Slavs, practiced this ritual too. Lots of classical and medieval reports bear witness to this. Of the Gauls, Julius Caesar, from 100 to 44 BC, the Roman general who conquered their country, wrote, quote, "This whole nation of the Gauls is very religious. For this reason, people who are very ill or who are in great danger during fights sacrifice human beings or promise to do so. For these sacrifices, they appeal to the Druids, for they think that the forces of the almighty gods cannot be calmed down unless one human being, killed another, has been sacrificed. Such sacrifices are organized on behalf of the state. Some of them make use of colossal puppets. They fill up the limbs of these puppets, which are braided with twigs, with living humans. Then they set them afire, and the humans die in the flames. They believe that the gods are in favor of capital punishment of people who were caught red-handed when stealing, committing robbery, or another crime. But when there are not enough criminals available, they are not afraid at all of executing innocent persons." That the Druids were indeed guilty of the practice or of human practices, it's confirmed by the fact that Emperor Tiberius, 42 to 37 AD, imposed restraints on Druidism for this very reason. This measure is all more striking when one realizes that the Romans used to be very tolerant towards religions of the nations they subdued. This also was true in principle as far as Judaism and Christianity were concerned, but that's another story. Oh, pages sticking together here. Romans appear to have displayed an aversion to human sacrifices. The practice of bringing human sacrifices still can be heard in the folklore of Brittany. For instance, the old folk song has been preserved wherein a legend is mentioned according to which the ancient times children were sacrificed to a deity in a place called Harbor of Laments. Nine poor children are weeping and kicking their feet. Nine mothers are mourning over them. We're even better informed on human sacrifices by the Teutonic nations. Medieval authors confirmed that their classical colleagues already had written long before them, so there can be no doubt about the existence of this practice, and archaeology affirms it. On the other hand, one has to bear in mind that both are the classical and the Christian writers consider the pagan Teutonic nations to be enemies, and so might have exaggerated things a bit. Okay. Well known is this text from the Greek historian Strabo, 63 BC to 26 AD, on the Teutonic tribe of the Cimbrians, which reads, quote, "It has been related that the Cimbrians had the following custom. Among the women who were with them on their campaigns were fortune-telling priestesses, gray with age, unshod, dressed in white clothes, with finely woven linen cloaks and bronze belts. These walked towards the prisoners in the camp with swords in their hands, wreaths in their heads, and led them to a bronze kettle containing about 20 measures. Then one of them mounted a step and, leaning over the kettle, cut through the throat of the prisoner, who was lifted over the edge. From the blood that streamed into the kettle, they told fortunes. Others cut upon the bodies, searching the entrails, and foretold victory for their men. During the battles, they drummed on skins, which were stretched over wagon baskets and made a frightening noise." Human sacrifices were mostly held in honor of Odin, or Wotan, the chief god of the Teutonic nations. From Swedish mythology, for instance, we know that the case of one On, a Swedish king who apparently was very keen on life, On was able to postpone his death time, and again by offering a son to Odin. But when the bedridden and senile king, after having sacrificed nine children to Odin, started to think about offering his tenth, the last son as well, his Swedish subjects had had enough. Up into the 9th century, sacrifices to Odin were reported. In the Orkneyinga saga, written down in Iceland about the year 1200, the following story is recorded. Earl Einar of the Orkneys beat in battle one Halfdan Longleg, a son of a Norwegian king, and took him prisoner. Halfdan managed to escape, but when by daybreak Einar and his men began to search the islands, the escaped prisoner was soon caught, and then, quote, Einar had his ribs cut from the spine with a sword and the lungs pulled out through the slits in his back. He dedicated the victory to Odin as a victory offering. When the Cimbrians and the Teutons in 1005 BC cut to pieces a Roman army of, as it is related, more than 100,000 men near Orange in France, they strangely enough did not capture loot or to take prisoners. Roman historian Paulus Aureus, beginning in the 5th century AD, relates, quote, the enemies who had stormed both Roman camps and who had captured an enormous amount of booty destroyed everything that fell into their hands by virtue of a remarkable and unusual oath. Garments were torn to pieces and trampled underfoot. Gold and silver were thrown in the river. The armor of the men was cut to pieces. The finery of the horses was destroyed. The horses themselves were drowned in a whirlpool of the river. The humans were hanged on a tree, so that there was neither booty for the victors nor mercy for the defeated. Probably we must understand this strange conduct in this way, that because of his oath, the prisoners and the loot had been dedicated in advance to the god Odin, most likely, and therefore were sacrificed to him after the battle. Oddly enough, we came across the same behavior in the Bible. In it, the talk is about the cursing of cities, like Jericho. In such towns, every human, every animal had to be slaughtered, and no booty was to be taken. Everybody and everything had to be offered to Yahweh. Religious madness, boys and girls, it's been with us a long time. Coming close to the custom of sacrificing human beings was the practice of sending into death living people with or without their approval. On the occasion of the funeral of important persons, both the Scythians, people with fair hair and blue eyes, who used to live in what is now the Ukraine and South Russia, the Teutons and the Celts did this, and in Homer's Iliad, the custom was also mentioned. The Celts used to carry with them as trophies the skulls of their slain opponents. The Scythians would drink out of the skulls of their defeated enemies. And the Irish Celts from Ulster are said to have the custom of mixing the brain of a slain adversary who had been killed in a duel with lime, and to let it all dry until the hardball had been produced, which could be used as a sling stone. The reader should not think too fast that the ancient writers gave their imagination free rein. Reality sometimes even surpasses them. For instance, some years ago, archaeologists in Rive Mansur, Ancre, in the north of France, some 50 kilometers from the northern northeast of Gorny, dug up a Celtic sanctuary. In this sanctuary, they found a huge pile of human bones under the collapsed remainder of a peculiar building, which the archaeologists stated called the Watch of the Headless Warriors. This building must have been some kind of high platform, which was roofed but otherwise open in all directions. On this podium seemed to have been a place the bodies of some 100 beheaded warriors, packed cheek by jowl, apparently to make sure that they kept standing upright. The warriors were in full armor. They must have been mummified somewhat, as they were dried out by the wind in their showroom, whereas the rain did not rot the bodies. The Icelanders still dry fish in this way. Sometimes violence can be good and necessary, for instance, when it comes to fighting against crime and injustice. But it is clear that those kinds of affairs are different. Here we are talking about violence that is not not there because it is needed. We're talking about violence that has another cause. What cause? As far as some customs are concerned, there exists a religious explanation which should not be confused with a moral justification. For instance, the Celtic practice of beheading the slain enemy seems to have originated from the belief that the beheaded people were not able to return among the living to make life hell for their victors. Another explanation for this kind of senseless violence may be supplied by the Latin word furor. Furor, F-U-R-O-R, means fury, rage, anger. Medieval chronicler Adam von Bremen, 1040 to 1072, used his word to explain the name of the Teutonic chief god Wotan. Wotan ist die Führer. Wotan, this means fury. The Dutch word for rage or fury is woad. Woden was not only the chief god, he was also the god of war and of death. Human sacrifices were mostly brought in his honor. Apparently, Wotan was the personification of something evil in the human soul. One can come across the Führer in certain wood carvings of the Viking Age. Take, for instance, the well-known human head from the famous Osberg ship. Do not his wide-eyed looks give the impression that this man is under the influence of some stimulants? The notion Führer has also to do with the strange phenomenon of the so-called berserks. These were madmen who much feared as warriors. They used to serve as crack troops of the kings and other important persons. Once they had come into their special battle fury, they went mad and bit their shields. From that one moment on, they were nearly invincible. The English language still preserves the expression to go berserk as a reminder of these warriors. Roman author Ammianus Marcellinus served as an officer in the army. In his capacity, he seems to have taken part in a battle the Romans fought in the year 357 AD near Strasbourg against the Teutonic tribe of the Alemans. This way he describes the onrushing troops of the enemy. Quote, as they came rushing with unusual violence, a strange fury made their flying hair stand on end, and some kind of madness seemed to light up in their eyes. There you go, boys. That's the way to do the job. Bite your shield and charge. I read where a lot of times these guys were totally naked. This Führer, which was personified by Wotan, was also present in the Teutonic love of fighting and war waging. Historical sources gave the impression that Celts and Teutons regarded war waging as some kind of national sport. Roman general Julius Caesar, not averse to some fighting himself, recounts this story about the Teutons. Quote, the greatest glory of the tribes consists in surrounding themselves with as large a desert as seems possible by divesting the territory of others. They regarded it as a sign of their bravery that their neighboring tribes are chased away and that nobody dares to settle down in a surrounding area. The Celtic Britons, too, were able to run wild and become furious. In the year 61 AD, the Britons rebelled against the Roman occupiers. The leader of the rebellion was a woman named Boudica, the queen of the Iceni tribe. In present Norfolk, according to Tacitus, some 70,000 Roman citizens and allies of theirs seem to have perished. The Britons showed no mercy, if they may believe Greek writer Cassius Dio, 150 to 235 AD, they perpetrated the most horrible misdeeds. Quote, but the most terrible and the most savage atrocity consisted in what follows. They hanged the most prominent and the most beautiful women nakedly, cut off their breasts and fixed them on to their mouths so that it looked as if these unfortunate were actually eating these parts of the body. Therefore, the Britons impaled them on pointy stakes, which they drove in length through the body. All these atrocities they committed, while at the same time sacrificing, laying on a feast, and giving their criminality free rein in other sanctuaries, but especially in the holy forest of Andraste. Unfortunately, one should be careful when reading these kind of stories, and not only those of ancient writers, but, by the way, exaggerating is, of all times, often enough, the propaganda of the victor becomes the history of the vanquished. On the other hand, the tenor of these stories always is the same. There comes to no end to the bloodletting, shedding, and cruelties. The general picture is consistent and clear. This is not only true as far as the classical authors are concerned. It goes for medieval chroniclers as well. It would be unwise to sublimate or minimize this reality, or for whatever reason. At any rate, we should not blindly idealize classical antiquity, certainly not with respect to the world of the Celts and the Teutons. On the other hand, it would be just as incorrect to go from one extreme to the other and to consider European heathendom as something definitely negative. Any fair observer will affirm that this is not the case at all. Actually, the civilizations of ancient Europe present an ambiguous character. Besides negative elements, they contain a lot of positive ones too. This is mirrored in their mythologies, in which not only negative deities like Odin and Woden were depicted, but in which a great number of positive forces make their appearance too. Just think of all those kind gods, elves, nymphs, and other good-natured supernatural beings. It is important to notice that in the Bible, this is not the case at all. In the Bible, there is no place for positive beings. The world of the Bible is dominated by one single personality, an absolutely negative personality of Yahweh. The positive aspects of the ancient European civilizations will be used in the next chapters as the moral norm on the basis of which the Bible doctrine will be judged. Finally, at the end of this book, the reader will be in a position to pronounce judgment on the thesis this book wants to prove. That is, that the philosophy and ethics of European heathendom, as far at least as these positive aspects are concerned, differs completely from those of the Bible. In fact, they are as different as day and night, or, to put it even more clearly, as good and evil. In fact, the European heathendom is the only available point of comparison when we exclude the hazardous option of consulting all kinds of ideological chimeras. For one special reason, it also happens to be the most interesting, even exciting, point of comparison. We will now see why. The doctrine of Christianity, with which we have become familiar after all these centuries, states that Christ has brought light to the humankind. From this moment on, humankind began a long and steady journey on the road of progress. In other words, thanks to Christianity spreading all over the world, the same world becomes better and better. The future is smiling at us, and the past is almost by definition worse than the present. The Christian worldview is a worldview of progress. The post-Christian philosophies also bear the stamp of these deep-rooted convictions. While strongly believing in progress, they are inclined to look down on the past, which in their view was backward and ignorant. The European pagans, those of the North Sea, and those at the Mediterranean held totally opposite views. They saw the world as degenerating steadily instead of improving. They thought that once to the distant past, a so-called golden age had existed, during which peace and prosperity had reigned and the world had been happy. In that period, spring, everlasting, and women and people used to be honest and fair on their own accord, that they did not need judges. There was just a little need for armies. After this wonderful age declined and degeneration had begun, which in the opinion of the Teutons would finally culminate in the end of this world, which they will call Ragnarok. After Ragnarok, a new world and a new golden age would come into being. The Roman poet Ovidius, 43 B.C. to 17 A.D., pictured this famous golden age as follows. Quote, golden was the first age in which no one to compel without a law of its own will kept faith and did right. There was no fear of punishment, No threatening words were to be read on the brazen tablets. No suppliant throng gazed fearfully upon its judge's face, but without judges lived secure. Not yet had the pine tree felled on its native mountains, descended thence into the watery plain to visit other lands. Men knew no shores except their own. Not yet were cities begirt with steep moats. There were no trumpets of straight, no horns of curved brass, no swords or helmets. There was no need at all of armed men, for nations secure from war's alarms passed the years in gentle ease. The earth herself, without compulsion, untouched by hoe or plow, of herself gave all things needful, and men in content with food which came with no man seeking, gathering the arbut fruit, strawberries, and the mountainside's cornel cherries and berries hanging, thinking about the prickly bramble, and the acorns fallen from the spreading tree of Jove. Then spring was everlasting, and the gentle zephyrs were warm breath playing with flowers that sprang unplanted. Anon, the earth, untilled, brought forth her stores of grain, and the fields, though uncultivated, grew white with the heavy bearded wheat. Streams of milk and streams of sweet nectar flowed, and yellow honey was distilled from the verdant oak. As could only be expected, modern historians and philosophers do not take seriously this idea of a golden age. It goes against the grain with them. For them, it is a foregone conclusion that the idea absolutely is remote from reality. Quote, this opinion stems from the deep-rooted craving of humankind for glorifying the good old days and for sublimating the dark sides of the past as much as possible. This view is typical of people who are completely absorbed in their rock faith in progress. For such people, the idea of the golden age in the dark and the barbarian past is inconceivable. It would demand a Copernican revolution of their world of thoughts before they would be able to swallow this. Nevertheless, as far as we are concerned, we assume that something like a golden age is historical. In other words, that this golden age has in some ways really existed. Why do we hold this opinion? Let us answer this question with another question. Why not? If the ancient mythologies of the Romans, Greeks, Teutons, and Celts alike tell us that a golden age has really existed, why should we not just accept that? It is simple, as the mythology never lies. It always contains a grain of truth. For what reason should we give more credit to the statements of modern historians than to the rock-solid, widespread belief of the ancients, handed down from father to son from time immemorial? Well, boys and girls, that's about it for today. Let me mark my place here before I forget. And we will be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, speaking of Wotan. And pretty interesting, huh? At least to me it is. I don't know. You're all out there asleep or drunk or something. I don't know. 14:05 and five words. Later. I think that's the reason they keep us all on a wheel, like these, what do you call them, gerbils or gobels or or these little rodents you put in a cage and they get on a wheel and just keep going. By telling us we've got to continue towards a better and better and better and better future. But yet you look all around and just say, is it really getting better? I think that's the game they play on us. Keep turning that wheel, baby. I know myself, I'd have no problem going back to at least the 40s and 50s. Beyond that, I don't know too much about except what my people tell me. But I would have no problem with that. And you could take all the little things they've dreamed up and all the little cell phones and all that and chunk them.
The most powerful proofs for the fabrication of the character called Jesus Christ is to be found in plain sight in every copy of the New Testament. if ever there was an elephant in the room, this is it. And what is it that I'm talking about? Well, actually, I'm referring to the Gospel of John, otherwise known as the Fourth Gospel. It's commonly called the Fourth Gospel today because that naive belief that it was written by an illiterate Aramaic-speaking son of Zebedee called John the Apostle is patently absurd. Whatever else it may be, John's Gospel most certainly is not the memoirs of an old fisherman writing theology in polished Greek at his retirement home and using Mark as a crib sheet. John's Gospel is notoriously anti-Jewish, referring constantly to the Jews in opposition to the good guys, the followers of Jesus, supposedly Jews themselves. The authors of this Gospel construct whole speeches, thousands of words long, put into the mouth of a Jesus who in the other Gospels only ever speaks in pithy soundbites or pre-packed parables. Nor does John's Jesus have much concern for the poor and needy, but endlessly espouses his own divinity, glory and importance. What we have in John's Gospel is Jesus the God, a divinity just visiting planet Earth and making known that only he is to be worshipped and adored. It is a formulation put together by unknown apostate Jews and Judaized pagans in the 2nd century, at a time when there was no longer the expectation of an imminent judgment day. Theirs is a God for the long haul, designed to compete with and supplant the competition, whether it came from rabbinic Judaism, baptizers, Gnostics, or the priests of Dionysus or Asclepius. In their Gospel of John, the authors take shots at all of these. Christians have always known that there were difficulties with the so-called Gospel of John, that it told a story often at odds with the three other Gospels, that it omitted many key episodes found in the Synoptic Gospels, including all those that named the Apostle John himself. But on the other hand, it introduced tales, miracles and characters quite unknown to the other evangelists, and which, if true, should have been mentioned by them. But over the centuries, Christians have found ways to sidestep the problems. That's why today they find it more convenient to jettison the purported author of the Gospel rather than the Gospel itself. Because, for better or worse, it's John's Gospel that defines many fundamental Christian beliefs, like the divinity of Christ, the immortality of the soul, or salvation by faith. Typically, Christian writers describe the Fourth Gospel not as another biography of Jesus, but as a reflection on the meaning of Jesus. And yet, for all of its grand and florid interpretations of the substance and meaning of Jesus, all those endless metaphors about bread from heaven, the living water, the true vine, the shepherd and his sheep, etc., John's Gospel, nonetheless, does present another retelling of the story of Jesus. And it's here that we'll begin, because that rewritten core story explains the overblown theological superstructure that swamps this Gospel. The first striking revision in the Fourth Gospel is that the ministry of Jesus has ballooned out from 1 year to 3. The writers make reference not just to 1, but to 3 distinct Passover festivals. Now, is this just a different tradition that some early Christians held to a tradition of a 3-year ministry and others to a 1-year ministry? Can anyone honestly maintain that whole dialogues could be remembered word for many decades, and yet believers have no common agreement whether these words were said during 1 year or during 3 years? Let me give you an alternative explanation. The writers of John's Gospel so drastically reorganized and rewrote the material inherited from Mark, Matthew and Luke that they created the need for 3 Passovers in order to fit in their new theology, restatements and dogmas. In Mark's original story, the drama builds to an eventual confrontation in Jerusalem, where Jesus drives out the money changers and cleanses the temple. From that moment on, the Jewish authorities plot to kill Jesus. Now, John's Gospel, dating from a much later time when the Christians are separated from the Jews, wants to emphasize this point of detachment and supersession. That faith in Christ is a complete break from the old and obsolete Judaism. So the cleansing of the temple is shifted to the start, not the end of Jesus' ministry. This is Passover number one. Now, having shifted the cleansing of the temple to the beginning of Jesus' ministry, John's chronology has lost the original climax of the story, so it needed a new trigger for the final events. This the authors provide by inventing a miracle that surpasses all earlier miracles, the raising of Lazarus after 4 days in the grave. This new miracle is merely a reworking of a parable found in Luke, but it does the trick. So in John's revised script, it's the raising of Lazarus that now impels the Jewish authorities to plot to kill Jesus. These events are added to the chronology at Passover number 2. But we're not finished. In the original tale, Jesus shares a Passover meal with his disciples and institutes a meal of remembrance of himself. But when the authors of John are writing, Christianity has already severed its Jewish roots and has adopted practices drawn from the pagan mystery religions. So John's Jesus doesn't share a Passover meal with his disciples. Instead, he becomes the Passover meal. It's for this reason, and not some curious slip in the collective memory, that in John's Gospel, the Last Supper and the crucifixion itself occur a day earlier than in the other Gospels. Jesus is prepared for his sacrifice on the very same day that Passover lambs are prepared. Now, making Jesus into the sacrificial Lamb of God is no minor point. At this stage, the Church is defining its dogmas and regularizing its sacraments. A halt has been called to further speculations and personal revelations. A deal-breaker becomes the willingness of would-be Christians to take part in the newly instituted Eucharist by eating Jesus' flesh and drinking his blood. So now we have the reason why John's Gospel adds a third Passover festival between Festivals 1 and 2. It is to allow Jesus himself to spell out the new Eucharist. The writers of John have Jesus leave Jerusalem and return to Galilee just before another Passover festival, where they insert the story of loaves and fishes from Mark's Gospel. And having regurgitated an embellished version of feeding the 5,000, John's Gospel now presents a great discourse on the bread of life, repurposing the food miracle as an introduction to something altogether different. At some length, Jesus explains to his followers the hard saying that they must eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood to have life. The text even records that many of the Jews stopped being Jesus' disciples at this point. We thus see that John's Gospel isn't the memory of a different tradition, with a number of curious anomalies but traceable nonetheless to an eyewitness of amazing events. On the contrary, the fourth Gospel is the handiwork of a church flexing its muscles and beginning to enjoy earthly rewards. Without embarrassment, the authors of John redact and revise the foundational story of Jesus. They reorder, they invent, they delete, and they lie to suit their own purposes. A whole gospel, a tissue of invention and fraud. But is John's Gospel unique? No, of course not. All the Gospels are a tissue of invention and fraud. But the lies get more cunning and self-serving with each re-editing.